Larry, let's start with Joe Biden. He suddenly decided to withdraw from 2024 presidential election. The question, one of the biggest questions right now in the mind of many people would be, who's running the show in the United States if Joe Biden doesn't fit to be the presidential nominee of the Democratic Party?
That's a question I've been asking myself for some time. It didn't take the debates and his miserable performance in the debates, Biden's, to make me worry. I was worried well before that because I did not see the Joe Biden with all the imperfections that he had that I saw when I was at the State Department and Colin Powell talked to him at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee when he was chairman and then when he was ranking member. When Dick Lugar took over for the Republicans, Powell still talked to Biden because he, as Powell said, and this is a direct quote, knows the foreign policy and security issues, unquote. Not the same Joe Biden in that, oh, the last year, last 18 months or so. And while I might have disagreed with his policies and the execution of them and disagreed with his selection of people for his primary staff, I still had some respect for him, but I lost that. And it was gone by the time the debates occurred. I didn't even watch the debates. I watched them in video afterwards, but I didn't watch them when they were happening. They were too painful for me because I saw a man crumbling before my very eyes, even a man that I might have disagreed with half the time. But nonetheless, I had some respect for him and he was crumbling before my eyes. So it's like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. These people don't know when to quit. She cost President Obama a Supreme Court seat because she would not step down. Those kind of people to me are dangerous people because they don't understand that they are not indispensable, and they don't understand that when they get in a position of power, and something like happened with Ginsburg, where she could have stepped down and he could have made a new appointment of a young person who would be there for a long time. And didn't. And then Biden, who was not going to step down, it didn't look like when he was clearly not in full possession of his faculties. So I'm happy it happened, but it was beyond time.
When it comes to Ukraine, Joseph Borrell said that 70% of Ukraine's energy capacity have been destroyed. It doesn't make sense to anybody when you look at the numbers. You cannot understand what's going on and why they're continuing this conflict and why Zelensky is not suggesting that he's willing to negotiate.
Washington won't let him. Jens Stoltenberg won't let him. Did you see Lavrov's July 16th, I believe it was, appearance at the UN Security Council? That was quite a performance by Sergei. It reminded me, it surpassed Gromyko. I mean, there's a reason the Soviets and now the Russians leave their foreign ministers in office for a long time. They get really good. I can remember Gromyko vividly when I was a young soldier. And now Sergei, I think in many respects as a diplomat in particular, probably because you have to enhance your diplomatic instrument when you fall off your military instrument for so long a time as they did post-Cold War. Sergei surpasses him, I think, even. And he started out by quoting George Orwell and Animal Farm. He quoted that passage where he says, all the animals are equal, except for some animals that are more equal. And of course, he meant us. And then he went on in that vein. He quoted UN Security Council resolutions against the situation in Ukraine and against Gaza, too. He quoted the one that says the Golan Heights occupation is illegal. And it is indeed illegal. And then he quoted Blinken saying, I understand it's illegal, but that doesn't matter. I mean, Lavrov just laid us low in terms of the way we've been dealing with the world and the way he sees us as having been dealing with the world, which is Russian perspective, yes, but a lot of it is just clarion truth. We are an ogre to much of the world right now. And he just quintessentially laid it out at the UN Security Council. So your question is very relevant. Why are we doing this? Why are we preventing, if we are, and I suspect we are, I suspect strongly we are, Zelensky from arriving at some kind of ceasefire and sit down for a peace agreement. Why are we preventing that? I think Sergei's right there too. Here he is quoted. I got to get this straight. This was beautiful. NATO summit. Sergei interpreting it. Granted, we had a change of translator there at the moment he was doing this, but I think they were pretty good. They sounded to me like they were genuine UN translators. You know, they can shift in a heartbeat, and they just keep up with the English, like just, you know, a guy replaces a girl, and then bang, 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 they're still going. He said, let's see about the NATO summit. NATO needs not to simply defend Europe. This is Sergei describing the summit, but to expand into the Pacific with preparation for protracted war with China and others. Who are the others? Who else are we going to fight in the Orient? You know, but that's right. Sergei says that's what they have decided to do. NATO has decided to do that. That's a defensive alliance. That's even an alliance for the defense of Europe. We're going to get together and we're going to go after China together with the United States. This is nonsense. And Sergei's right. It is nonsense. I don't know where I don't know what they're doing. I don't know why they're saying these things. It can't just all be lackeyhood. It can't just be because they're all poodles of Washington. They must have aspirations to make NATO the empire's defender. And I can't understand how they are going to believe, or how they believe, that they can sustain that politically. It's already coming unraveled, of course. It's coming unraveled in France. It's already unraveled in Slovakia and Hungary. It's probably going to unravel in Germany as soon as the present chancellor is gone, which is going to be pretty soon. It's probably going to unravel all across Europe. In fact, I don't say probably anymore. It will unravel. It's just a question of how long will it take it to unravel.
It seems that the Europeans are in panic with what has happened in the United States, considering Joe Biden. How do you find it right now in Europe?
The first thing they do is misinterpret our situation, which is not uncommon. Throughout my entire diplomatic career, if you will, and I include in that my time with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, because I probably effected more diplomacy there and more powerfully than I ever did at the State Department, because America's military is its leading edge of its diplomacy, unfortunately. But I'll tell you this, the Europeans never get us right. And Trump will not change an iota. He may speak about it. He may claim. He may look like he's going to do something, but he will not change an iota of the policy that Joe Biden is implementing right now with respect to Europe. Now, there might be some economic tariffs. There might be some things that he does on the edges, and he might yell here and yell there. But I don't think he's going to change anything in terms of security policy. I do not think he's a warmonger. I don't think he's that. So I don't think he's going to start any fresh wars, and he may indeed curtail things in that regard. And if he does that, I might cast a vote for him. that's saying a lot. But I think the Europeans are interpreting it wrong, and they're getting scared for no reason to get scared. And if he were to bring some sanity to it, for example, shut the Ukraine war down on a reasonable basis with a ceasefire and a peace agreement, I'd be in the front row cheering. And I think everybody should be. I think probably 55-56% of America would be too.
We've learned that Ukraine has blocked the transit of oil from Russia to Hungary. And do you understand why they're doing this? At the same time, they want to be part of the EU?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised that they are being egged on in that regard by Stoltenberg and his crew. Let's teach these recalcitrant NATO members a lesson. So I'm not saying I'm ordering you to do it, but if you want to do it, we'll support you. You know, that wouldn't surprise me at all. Just like we took out Nord Stream 2. I mean, what a hell of a thing to do to our principal NATO ally in Europe, Germany. But we did it. We did it. And we did it for a number of reasons. In my view, we did it so we could make money, because now we're selling them that oil at a higher price and a more environmentally degrading way, because our oil is more not as clean as Russian oil. It's fracked oil. And we also probably ended the best manufacturing economy in the world, of its size and shape, maybe even in the world period, China notwithstanding. We ruined it, and we ruined it almost overnight by doing what we did to the cheap energy picture in Germany. How the Germans could not figure that out and how they could not be angry about it is beyond me. And that's the reason I'd say I don't think their government is going to look anything like it looks right now when Schulz is gone.
Why Europe is doing this right now? What would be the benefit coming out of the conflict in Ukraine for Europe? Europe is not gaining anything if you look at the conflict in Ukraine, even the conflict with China.
There is an element in Europe which more or less dovetails, lines up with the neoconservative element in the United States. And they find coincidence of views principally on China. And that's both an economic coincidence of views, that is to say, they do not want China competing with them. They think that the potential for China dwarfing Europe and the United States, that's kind of unbelievable since together they have an almost $40 trillion GDP. But they think that that threat from China is really existential almost, that economic threat. And so they want to do something about it. And second, they've seen the money that can be generated by war and by the way the United States does war. And they like it. And so there's this coincidence of views about aligning themselves with the United States and using NATO as the chapeau for that alignment and taking on China, at least in a way that threatens so significantly that China more or less has to sort of recede a bit and backs off some of the things like the Base Road Initiative, and so, which was going to have a terminus in Ukraine. Ukraine was going to be, you know, people forget. The richest farmland on the face of the earth, from every farmer I've ever talked to, from almost Japan to China, is in Ukraine. It is so rich that the saying in Ukraine was, you toss a seed out and before you know it, you can eat it because it's grown. And the steppes of Russia right abutting that are not too bad either. Well, that's what the Wehrmacht wanted when it invaded in June of 1941. We're going to feed Germany and their troops on it, 4 million troops. So that's coveted. And they don't want China to have anything to do with it. They don't want China doing the Base Road Initiative. They don't want Chinese workers in there farming the land. They don't want China to have anything to do with it. And so they see the only way to keep her out is to solidify NATO with Washington's nuclear weapon backing and take on China. Now, does that mean they actually want a war with China? That's a huge question for me. Some of them, I think the answer is yes, a resounding yes. They want a war, and they want it sooner rather than later because they see China growing. All of their intelligence communities are telling them that if you're going to have a war, you need it now, not tomorrow or the next week, because China's growing stronger and stronger and stronger. Don't listen to those people that say they have economic problems. Don't listen to those people that say they have demographic problems. Those will just be a spur to China to beat you to the punch and start the war themselves. So, and they think most of them, especially the hardcore cusp of them, both European and American, think that China's going to take Taiwan and use Ukraine as an example of how successful they can be, because Russia has done what it's done and really has not invited the full panoply of power of NATO. So China could, you know, take Taiwan and it wouldn't invite any response either. They want China to think not only will the United States respond, so will Europe. So, I mean, this is insanity. I mean, I can't think of a better word for it. It's insanity. It's a way to make the world have existential threats. Nuclear weapons with no treaties and this stupid, stupid policy and strategy. But that's how they believe. And it appears to me, as Sergei pointed out, that that's what the NATO summit produced. Is it all to scare China? Is it all to frighten her into retreat or whatever? That's not going to work. And second, that's almost as insane as the policy itself. The pendulum's swinging in the world. If you've read that book I talk about a lot, Peter Farrakhan's book, A New History of the World, The Silk Roads, you see that the East, as it were, China, Central Asia, Persia, were all powerful for years and years and years and years. The West was nothing. Western Europe was nothing. It was a bunch of vassals of the Roman Empire or whatever. They were Visigoths and terrible people. And the New World wasn't even known about, of course. The pendulum's swinging. The pendulum's swinging back the other way. It's swinging back towards the Orient, back towards the East, back towards Central Asia, back towards all the places where massive empires were built for over two millennia. And we don't seem to get that. And the Europeans don't seem to get that. And if they do get it, they're angry as hell. And they want to reverse that pendulum swing. I got news for them. That's going to be awfully hard. That's going to be awfully hard.
Is it possible to fight China without going nuclear?
I don't think so. I really don't. Not if we really fight. Now, I think the central core of these neoconservatives and their brothers and cousins in Europe thinks they can get away with this without going to nuclear war. But if we actually go to war, whether it's over Taiwan or some other instance, say with the Philippines or with Vietnam or whatever it might be, if we actually go to a conventional kind of exchange, it'll evolve to nuclear. Because my Marines used to put it this way. They gave me a mug, a beer mug, with the shark and the whale on it and my name down underneath it. Because that was my metaphor for our war games. We would say, well, look, the shark, the United States, cannot go ashore. Never have a land war in Asia, the Princess Bride, you know. You never want to have a land war in Asia. We could, our army, our navy, our Marine Corps, if it went ashore, it'd be swallowed in 5 days. So we couldn't go ashore in China to fight them. Well, they're not going to come, the elephant is not going to come in the ocean to fight us, except peripherally, maybe in the South China Sea. And we'd have quite a battle there, but I think we'd probably win it ultimately. So here we are sitting at each other. 2 million man army. Still got an intact Navy, but it's a fleet in being. It's in port. And they still got a powerful Air Force. And, oh, my God, a missile force that's unimaginable. So what are we going to do? We're going to sit out at sea, and that's the way our war games would evolve. We're out at sea with our forces heavily attrited, lost 30% of our Air Force, 30% of our Naval Air Force, probably 30% of our shipping, probably a little higher than that of our shipping. Chinese have lost similarly, and we're looking at each other. And someone on one side or another says, and we used to play these games with what we called a red team. And the red team was very conversant with Chinese doctrine. So they played like Chinese. Someone on one side or the other, usually it would happen both sides at the same time, would say, okay, let's put a nuclear weapon on Shanghai. Or let's put a nuclear weapon somewhere in Fujian province, or let's put a nuclear weapon here, or a nuclear weapon there, and then they'll quit. And then the civilian people who would be the leaders in the war game, they'd be playing the president, secretary of state, and so forth. I remember Bill Perry was one time. And they'll say, we're not going there. War game's ended. But that's where you wind up. You wind up the only way you can influence the other state, and the only way they can influence you, is through use of nuclear weapons, or you quit. How many times in history have you seen two gigantic powers go after each other, and after the initial bloodletting, which is going to be horrendous, going to be probably 100, 200,000 casualties on both sides in that first furious meeting, how many times have you seen them quit? No, they upped the ante. And I think that's what you're talking about. I think we'd wind up going nuclear. These people don't want to talk about that. They don't want to think about that. They think they can control that. That's hogwash. Scary thing. There are people in China, and I have talked with some of them, and people in Russia, and I've seen it in Ukraine and in Lavrov and Putin's comments, who think they can control it too. And that's dangerous, in my view, very dangerous, because I don't think anyone can control nuclear war once it gets let out of the genies out of the bottle.
Do you think that Europe would behave the same way that they have been during this conflict in Ukraine, or they're going to oppose the United States policy to fight China?
I think the European people have not been consulted. I would dare say probably less than a third of them even know what came out of the NATO summit or care. Once they are aware, however that may happen, and I suspect as governments change, the politics of those changes will make them aware, vividly aware, probably in some cases, like, for example, Germany. And then that's going to be the end of the road. That's the reason I say I don't think NATO has a future. And I think the transatlantic relationship may take a grievous blow, even to the point where it's sundered, broken. Because once the people of Europe wake up, they're not generally a warmongering people individually. Now, they've had a lot of wars. They've done a lot of fun. Maybe that's one reason I think they're not warmongering people individually today. I mean, I've been to most of the European countries. You just don't find the kind of talk that you find in the United States, except amongst that group of people I just described to you, the Jens Stoltenbergs and the Mark Rutes and the others like them. I think once they are alerted to the situation and they change their governments slowly and surely over time, I think we're going to have an entirely different Europe. And it's not going to be our poodle. And then what they're going to have to figure out is what kind of a security arrangement do they build for themselves? And what are they willing to dedicate to it? What are they willing to pay for it? What are the different governments willing to do to create interoperability? And because, you know, we have done a lot, Nima. Most people don't know this. We have done a lot to create interoperability within NATO forces. Now, what that means is the Norwegians can operate with the Swedes, can operate with the Dutch, can operate with the French, and so forth, to an extent. It doesn't go to the point that, you know, the United States makes everything for them and they have to use all our equipment. But it is fairly interoperable. That's one of the great success stories of NATO. Well, if you create your own security identity, you've got to break away from that, because the core of that interoperability is U.S. You pull the U.S. out of it, and a lot of that interoperability goes away. A lot of the doctrine goes away, because you've got all individually different doctrines and different things and different ways you do business. The Finns have this, you know, the Finns conscript force can only defend Finland. Their professional force, like our all-volunteer force, you know, they're all volunteers and they get paid, they can go abroad. That's a fine tuning of what I'm talking about in terms of interoperability and doctrine and so forth. Those home troops can do anything with NATO. They can defend NATO territory. They can defend Finland. The others can do it, but they're trained to go and do things supposedly for Finland. When's the last time Finland did anything? Well, I think it was it was Norway, I think, that led the Libyan strikes in 2011, I believe it was. That's going to all have to change, and that's going to take a while. They're going to have to put their own apparatus together. They're going to have to develop doctrine for it, and they're going to have to build the equipment in their own factories, in their own plants, in their own industrial base. Are they willing to do that? Are they willing to dedicate the kind of 3 to 3.5 to 4% of GDP in each of those countries that would be necessary to do that? And more importantly, are they willing to create some kind of command structure that will emulate NATO, but not be NATO? That is to say, they will all answer to it. Paris, Berlin, all the rest of them answer to it. I don't know. That's a huge question. Or will they fall apart and just be individual states worried sick about the individual state on their east and their west and so forth, typical European? I don't know. I don't know how that will evolve, but I think it should be up to them, not up to Washington. And I think that's what they'll conclude after they get out of this, you know, we're going to get together and we're going to prep for protracted war with China. I can't believe they would print that. Is that supposed to scare the Chinese so badly that you don't have to do it? Is that your purpose? If so, I got news for them. You don't scare the Chinese with rhetoric.
Larry, it seems that whoever going to be the next president of the United States, we're going to have some sort of reduction in the importance of the continuation of the war in Ukraine. And do you feel it's going that way?
Well, I don't think the Democratic Party can back away from it too fast, because that would make them look like the idiots they are. But I do think I think after the election and things quiet down, maybe after the inauguration, that's a long time and a lot of dead Ukrainians. I'm not sure Zelensky can hold on that long. So there could be precipitous events in that time period that could cause it to collapse. Let's say the whole Ukrainian army virtually surrenders from north to south. I mean, what are they going to do then? The Russians are going to have a hard time taking so many prisoners. That'll be their biggest, it'd be like some of the times in World War II in the latter years where, we had so many prisoners, we didn't know how to deal with them. I'm told now, and this is competent demographers. They're telling me that Ukraine started out with probably close to 40 million people, and that they're down now to people inside their borders to about 22 million. That's 50% of the country that's either been killed, wounded, or has egressed the country. I don't know how you keep it up. Now, they seem to have a remarkable tenacity for keeping it up, but I just can't. I agree with John Mearsheimer and some of the others that are being extremely pessimistic about it right now. And I say, I don't, there are people who are saying this could grind on for 2 or 3 years. I don't think it can, because I think it's going to be humanly impossible for Ukraine to field anything that could even hope to stand up to a Russian onslaught. So all you're asking is to lose all your country, to lose the whole country. And all we're asking is to have the Russian columns at the Polish border. This is stupid. This is insane.
What's so amazing that Arestovich recently said that they're going to do a new counteroffensive on Russians. And the other thing that he said after that interview, he said that Russia is a big country, is a big army. And if I were Putin, I would do the same thing that Putin did in Ukraine. It's unbelievable when they're talking this way. It seems that the reality is coming to their mind. Why we are doing this? Why we were doing this all these 2 years, more than 2 years?
Those are all good points and good questions. I understand right now, and this is from pretty good authority too, that I think everyone knows this who's apprised of the situation, but Putin has restricted almost completely recruiting and drafting in the Moscow area. He wants to keep those people very much on his side, so he dare not recruit them, draft them, or whatever. So what he's doing is he's recruiting and drafting way out in the hinterland, which Russia has masses of course. In the hinterland, he has 300,000 troops he's recruited who are trained, they're finished their training, they're ready to go. They're, in some respects, anxious to go. They'd rather go than, sit there and whatever, especially with the winter coming on. So 300,000 troops, that's just 100,000 less than Ukraine has lost. And he's got that kind of reserve and capability to throw into anything that would be defensive against a Ukrainian onslaught. And I hate to use that term because they don't have the onslaught capability. This is nonsense, as you said. It's just sheer insanity. They're going to get eaten up like a meat grinder. They're just going to beat themselves to death on Russian defenses if they do try to start an offensive that are formidable to the point of not. And look at the air power. Russia's got control of the skies now. So it's just suicide. It's suicidal. But I don't put that past Ukraine. I don't put it past them. You look at their history in World War II and in World War I and other times. It reminds me of, as I keep telling people, you remember those Jewish fighters who went up on the cliffs, the Masada, while the 10th Roman Legion was down in the foothills and committed suicide up there? That's kind of what it reminds me of. Ukraine doesn't have a mountain it can climb and stand on, and all of its people commit suicide. And I don't think Zelensky would do that anyway. He would run off to his chalet somewhere in Switzerland. with his money trailing out his back pocket, along with the rest of the oligarchs. But that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the state of Ukraine disappearing under Russian tank treads.
How do you see the conflict in Gaza right now?
That's another thing that Sergei covered. He went through the UN resolutions, including the one that said the Golan Heights were illegal. And then he quoted Blinken saying, we don't care about the law. You know, essentially, that's what he said. I'm hearing some gruesome things there, too. Not only that the Houthis have joined the fight for real now and attacked Tel Aviv and killed one person, I think, and wounded some others, and showed that they could get through the absolutely impregnable Iron Dome with just a simple drone and do some damage. The Houthis are really remarkable people in my mind. I mean, you know, I'm not cheering them or anything like that, but they are remarkable people. And I think I told you, I used to train Yemeni soldiers. And I know that they're former goat herders and sheep herders and things like that, but they're tough people. They're wiry and they're tough people. And we saw the civil war between the North and the South, how much the casualties didn't bother them. And we've seen what the Saudis and the UAE ran into. Little Sparta, UAE, backed out. It was too tough. These guys and gals, too, they're a formidable force. And if they're going to enter the fray, and let's just face it, it's not Iran that's giving them these sophisticated missiles. No, no, no. It's Moscow. And, you know, we don't want to say that. We don't want to say that. Putin probably doesn't want to say that outright. He might say it, though, if he gets pissed off enough. But that's where they're getting these very sophisticated missiles. That means they can get others. That means they can get a lot of others, probably. And he doesn't need all these things in Ukraine. And putting a few down there where the Houthis can shoot them at Israel, and putting a few maybe other places where they can shoot them at people that'll bother the United States, that's the other aspect of this conflict in Ukraine that we're paying no attention to. This could spread, and it could spread. Someone asked me the other day, do you think the European conflict could lead to a regional war, maybe even a global war? I said, yes, but not nearly as swiftly and as dramatically as what's happening in the Eastern Mediterranean. Have you looked at it? Have you understand how many antagonists we have now? And do you understand what some of the other countries who've never been able to defeat Israel tried majorly twice, more than that, but twice majorly, came close in the Yom Kippur War, but ultimately were defeated. Do you realize you're rising up in the hearts of these people, the potential for taking out this state that's been such a pissant to them for 70 plus years? You're creating all these people out there who are thinking in these terms, and you're creating all these links, and you've got people like Russia and Iran to arm them. And I wouldn't even be surprised that ultimately the Chinese wouldn't pitch in here too, maybe through Russia or through Iran. But nonetheless, they see an opportunity. Here's the key: to bleed the United States. What we're trying to do to Russia, and ultimately, according to the NATO summit, to China, to turn our own strategy, as insane as it is, on us and to bleed us. And the best place to do that is in the Middle East, and to do it with Hezbollah, and to do it with the Houthis, and to do it with anybody else who will pitch in, including Iraqi and Syrian militias. Russia might change its mind. Right now, Putin's holding Bashar al-Assad back. Putin has told Assad, don't you do anything. If you send rounds into the Golan Heights, make sure they don't hit anybody. So he sent a few artillery rounds. But don't do anything that will get Israel attacking you. You know, they really attacked the Iranians when they hit that consulate in Syria. So he could change his mind. At any time, he could change his mind, especially if he thinks he's got enough of an upper hand in Ukraine to do something elsewhere and to do it forcefully. We could see a regional war spiraling into a much bigger war when the United States figures out what's going on, because all these militias are attacking Israel and Israel is going down. You know, I was told 2 days ago, I want to check with you. Have you ever interviewed Shir Haver, who's the economist who got kicked out, I think, of Tel Aviv because he was so anti-Netanyahu? he's in Europe now. But I think it was Scheer that was on, and he said, Eilat is bankrupt. That port is bankrupt now. And you got to think that a lot of this, that's up in the top of the Gulf of Aqaba off the Red Sea. So you got to think, and that's the only port the Israelis have pointing in that direction. You got to think that that's probably because of Red Sea commerce, that things have not been getting through. And so it's bankrupt. He also told me that there are some 30,000 or so Israeli businesses, you know, one man all the way up to a corporation, that are bankrupt. So the economy is beginning to fall apart in Israel. Not only that, more and more people are immigrating too. If Scheer's right, if that kind of impact, and a lot of the protests now, of course, there's 120 hostages, I think, they still have not gotten out. A lot of the protests in Tel Aviv and elsewhere, the more virulent ones, are about the hostages because they're furious with Netanyahu for not doing more to get the hostages out. And they see him as stalling to keep the war going. And he doesn't care about the hostages. I think they're right. He doesn't care about the hostages. And they've also now, through various publications feeding back into Israel, they've learned that on October the 7th, the IDF killed at least half, maybe more, of the people who died on that day. So that's not making them happy either. That's a situation, I think, that's more a tinderbox than Ukraine.
How this reality gonna be perceived in Israel, and how is it going to influence their opinion on Netanyahu administration?
As long as Netanyahu has the hold politically that he does on the people and on his cabinet and the Knesset, I don't see anything breaking anytime soon that might be ameliorating this situation. I'm going down to the Capitol building to protest. I'm going to be down there with a bunch of other people. I hope we have thousands down there to protest his speaking to Congress. I cannot believe that Senator Chuck Schumer, who got up and just lambasted Netanyahu personally, he made sure he wasn't talking about Israel. He just took on Netanyahu. He saw all those Senate seats maybe going away that he thought they were going to win, and Gaza was the big issue. So he lambasted, and then he signed on as the leader of the Senate. He signed on. If he'd said no, Netanyahu couldn't come. But he said yes. And of course, that lickspittle son of a bitch in the House, Johnson, that Christian moron in the House, he was, oh, yeah, oh, Bibi, you got to have Bibi here. He's the most dangerous man in the United States right now in many respects. So we're gonna protest. We're going to go over there. I hope we have thousands to protest. It won't make any difference, but at least we will show that the American people, some of us, are not happy with Bibi coming to our Capitol building to talk to our Congress. But that's going to be, he's going to ask Lindsey Graham, Tom Cotton, Josh Hawley, and a host of others, the leadership. He's going to ask in private meetings that the United States guarantee they had his back if he goes after Hezbollah, full out going after Lebanon and Hezbollah. Then he's going to ask, if I get bogged down, can you help me with Iran? Part of his strike, 1,800 miles, I think it was, if I remember right, part of his strike on the Houthis in retaliation for the drone hitting Tel Aviv was to demonstrate to the Iranians that they had the legs to deliver a strike on any place in the region. Now, they did that with some extraordinary tanking that we have made sure over the last few years that they have. We've even, as I understand it, I was tracking this when I was at State, but I've lost track of it. I don't know how you could reestablish it, but we were making sure that they had enough tankers to strike Iran's nuclear facilities all on their own, because that's what you need. You got to retank and retank and retank. And then if you want your pilots to come home, you got to tank them coming back, because they don't have the legs unless you do that. So that strike on Yemen was to show, I think, partly Iran that, hey, look, we've got 1,800 mile legs. Bet you didn't think we had those. Does he have them for a fleet large enough to really do a lot of damage? I don't know. But I suspect he probably does, because we've been beefing him up every year, a little bit at a time. So there's another potential. You know, he gets permission for the Hezbollah business. I think he will. I think they'll give him permission to do that. And they'll tell him, we'll back him up in the Eastern Med. We carry our air power and other Al-Udeid and other air power. We'll back him up. And then we'll be in that mess, destroying Lebanon once again. And then Iran will do something. I don't know what it'll be, but they will do something. They don't want to, especially under the new president. They do not want to do it. He's made every overture through every good office, Oman and other places, to let us know that he doesn't want to do anything, that he wants to keep things. He does not want a war with the United States. By the way, the previous hardcore government was the same way. Raisi was the same way. Don't want a war with the United States. But that's what Bibi's going to ask for. He's going to ask for U.S. cover for Hezbollah for sure. And I'm not sure we're going to give it to him for Iran. Even these lickspittle people in the Congress, I don't think they're going to be willing to sign up for Iran. So then the question is, what does Bibi do? Does he go ahead with Hezbollah and let it stop there? What does Iran do if he does Lebanon really in a big way? What does Turkey do? What do other countries do that might have an interest in this? Erdogan has let it be sort of felt out that he's not going to be happy with Lebanon going down either. So what's he going to do? That's the reason I say this has the potential for a wider war, even more so than Ukraine.
We've learned that Bashar al-Assad and Erdogan going to talk to each other in Moscow. And these changes...
What a place for Erdogan to be going. What a signal to send.
Yeah. Well, how do you find it? How do you find the changes that are happening? It seems to me that Washington doesn't consider what's going on.
Well, I think you could put a sort of a codicil on all the statements that Sergei made at the UN Security Council on 16 July that said something like, when he criticized Bretton Woods and WTO and the U.S. hegemony in the world, economic particularly, it needs to be replaced. You can put the codicil on the other side of that. Every statement he made about even the animal farm, you know, all the animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. Well, that's ending. You are not more equal than others, United States. That was the whole hint with every statement that Sergei made. He's very good at that. You know, I deliver the predicate, you supply the end. And I think he's right. I think he's right. I think the bow wave of history is moving away from the West and back towards the East, economically, financially, state power wise. And I think we are crazy not to recognize that, absorb the lessons from it, and try to deal with it from a diplomatic, economic, and financial standpoint, and throw away this idea that we're going to beat everybody with our weapons and our military until they, you know, restore our empire. That's impossible. In my view, that's impossible. So I'm just reading about Anthony Eden and the 56 and the Suez Canal crisis and the end of the British Empire, really. Of course, it had begun to unwind with World War One and World War Two. But the one interesting aspect of it was Eisenhower's threat to Eden to make a run on the pound at the IMF. And that did it. That did it. He, you know, he realized we're bankrupt. We are bankrupt. And therefore, I have no choice. I have to do what President Eisenhower is telling me to do. So I'm get my troops out of the Suez. The only people who were recalcitrant and who lingered and lingered and lingered in Suez to Nasser's great anger were the Israelis. The Israelis were the last to go, and we almost had to go over there and pry them out with a knife. Always mucking things up wherever they can.
Larry, if Netanyahu gets the permission to attack Hezbollah, do you think that they're going to go on the ground? They're going to set fighter jets to attack Hezbollah? And with the current situation of the Israeli army, that we know that in terms of their tanks, everything, their army is not that good. how they can do that.
In 2006, you didn't add, I would add, they got their butt handed to them by Hezbollah. So they have a new respect for Hezbollah, or at least those who remember those days do. And some of the officers are now division commanders and things like that. So they probably do remember those days. If they go in on the ground, it'll be worse than 1982 in some respects, where we had to go in and bail them out. And they may be expecting that. They may be expecting that we'll come in and bail them out. Remember, we put Marines in there and we put New Jersey off the coast and fired our 16-inch guns into the hills and, you know, made a mess of Lebanon is what we did. And we lost 242 Marines and Navy corpsmen in that hotel blast, which taught Ronald Reagan a lesson really quickly. So we backed off sort of and did most things from offshore. But that's probably what they would be counting on, is that if they do go in on the ground and they get in a mess, we would bail them out. And that's what I hope they get told, Netanyahu gets told in this visit on the 24th to the Congress, we won't do. But I don't know that. I don't know that. I think we'll tell him we'll back him up with air power and we'll back him up with, you know, whatever missile power we need and so forth. But I don't think we're going to tell him we'll back him up with ground troops. We're not going to put ground troops into Lebanon like we did in 82, 83. So I don't know what that means other than Netanyahu might not do it. And I hope that is behind us telling him we won't, is our aspiration that he won't. If we won't be there through thick and thin, he won't do it, because he should know. I don't know, the guy's really shown how desperate he can be at times, but he should know he can't do it by himself. Hezbollah will hand him his rear end once again. And that, you know, you get Hamas handing him his rear end in Gaza, and they really are now. They really are. For the power that they have, they are holding up the most advanced, most well-supplied, most thoroughly backed by the superpower in the world called America, army in the world. They're holding it up, and they're killing people, and they're destroying tanks, and they're destroying artillery pieces, and they're killing people. Okay, let's do that on the other flank, and maybe even do it to a greater degree quicker. What you going to do now, Bibi? You are going to not just have your Jewish state go away, as I predicted for some time. Can't be a Jewish state there. It just is untenable. You're going to lose it entirely. You're going to lose it in an act of warfare, and you're not going to resurrect it. So, because at the end of the day, when that starts to happen, they will unass that place so fast, it'll look like a desert within a week. As fast as planes can leave Tel Aviv, as fast as planes can leave other airports, as fast as they can get across the border into Egypt and take a plane out of Cairo or wherever, they will do that. And it'll be the end of the experiment. That's a resolution that is becoming more and more believable as a possibility every day that goes by, that Netanyahu persists in this kind of warfare and this kind of riling up and incentivizing not only the local powers, but other powers who have other motivations to help them do it. All of which we apparently are not looking at. Or if we are, we're even dumber than I thought.